Hello and welcome to the REIT Report. I'm your host, Sarah Vaughs from Quito, and joining me today is Bernhard Krieg, Managing Director and Portfolio Manager on the Real Estate Equities team for Brookfield's Public Securities Group. Bernhard and his team invest approximately $4.3 billion over multiple real estate asset classes. Bernhard, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you.
Now, let me start by asking you about the shifts you may have seen between real estate value and growth stocks in the last few months. And where do things stand at present in terms of investor preferences?
Sarah, that's a big question we're struggling with every day or working on every day. Clearly, it has been a big shift. And some of it, I would say, has been a bit of a continuation of what has happened prior to COVID. There has already been a bit of a divergence between some of the more growth-oriented names and some of the more value-oriented names. And COVID really, in certain ways, really accelerated some of these trends and has created further divergence. So if you think of positive trends like logistics, you know, the use of e-commerce had seen a huge surge as people are using were either not allowed to go into stores physically, or certainly some of them, or just preferred the comfort and the safety of their own home to get the things delivered to them. So there was a huge shift benefiting some property types like logistics. Certainly we all consume a lot more data being at home, whether that's our kids doing remote schooling or us all working from home, or just not being able to do as many things outside and using our Netflix account more. So those are like positive shifts. On the other hand, there were some negative shifts, right? Things that involve congregation, right? Real estate is a place that where people meet and come together, and that has been incredibly out of fashion over the last few months. And so those sectors have really been detrimentally impacted by this current pandemic. And with that, valuations have, understandably shifted out between the two of them, between the haves, logistics, data centers, for example, and the have-nots. If you think of hospitality, if you think of retail, restaurants, those would be clearly the hardest hit ones. And so some of this is driven by a fundamental shift. Now, for us, it's very important to think about which of these shifts are temporary and which of these shifts are maybe more permanent. While we also don't know how long these kind of social distancing environments will continue to last. I think nobody really knows that. We are continuing to be optimistic that this will be a finite time. And of course, the whole world is racing to try to come up with better treatments, with vaccines. We all try to figure out better ways while this is going on, how to keep going on with our lives and deal with it through more, I would say, refined measures of social distancing rather than, the blunt measures that were taken early on where everybody's like, okay, everybody stay at home, nobody move. That's going to be the safest. We're trying to be a little bit more thoughtful on how we're achieving the same goals from a regulation or a regulatory perspective. And so now the question for us is really, which is not too dissimilar than often what we're dealing with, how much of it is priced in, how long will it take for these effects to wear off, because to a certain degree they are not permanent in our view. I think one of the things that comes to my mind would be a few days ago you might have seen the front page of the Wall Street Journal showing a picture of a water park in Wuhan where there were so many people underwater that you couldn't even see the water itself anymore. Mm-hmm. And if I would have told you 6 months ago that, at the very center of the epidemic, 6 months later, you will see this picture, you would have probably thought I'm crazy. If I would have said the same thing 4 months ago at the height of the pandemic, in early April, that would have maybe even sound even more crazy as almost the entire world was locked down. So sometimes these shifts are hard to imagine and hard to foresee. And it's easy sometimes to extrapolate most recent trends and think there will not change materially. And it is our view that we are going to revert back to normal. And investing globally, I think, gives us some important perspective on some of the markets where the pandemic has subsided, like in China. We are seeing behavior revert back to very similar levels to what we've seen prior to the pandemic in many, many ways. And so we think a similar thing will be upon us when we are on the other side of this pandemic.
And among those sectors that you mentioned that were hit hardest by the pandemic, which among those do you think could have the greatest scope for rebound?
Clearly anything sort of travel related, right, would be very high on the list, naturally. And that was the market understood that very, from a downside perspective, very early on, of course, too, that one of the easiest things to do is, like, if it's sort of dangerous to mingle, well, don't travel, right? And so those stocks were the earliest ones to get hit really hard, anything hotel related, travel related. And we do think there's very, very significant upside as people revert back to normal. And we start to get a little bit of a glimpse of it also in some of the summer travel, both here in the U.S., but also in places like Europe, where people really, have been sort of cooped up inside for too long and would really like to take advantage to be able to go outside again. Business travel, on the other hand, hasn't really recovered that meaningfully yet, but we think it will come in time. Other sectors that we find very attractive today is areas that have been in the short run very meaningfully impacted, where the cash flows and the operations have been very meaningfully impacted, but their long-term prospects are actually quite good. One area in particular that comes to mind would be senior housing, where this is an area that has a very strong long-term demographic story behind it. We're facing an aging population. The needs are going to continue to increase over time. As you well know, the sector has in the past at times been marred by too enthusiastic projections of that demand and therefore too much supply being built. There was an episode of that a couple of years ago. But that's a sector that currently has been very severely impacted by COVID, not only because the virus is most dangerous for that particular age group of the 80-plus-year-old, but also in order to prevent any additional spreads, most of these facilities have been locked down. They're not really – they were for a while not taking in any new patients or residents, and even after they started to reopen this summer, so far it's been relatively slow. And given the average duration of stay of only about 2.5 years, they have experienced a significant deterioration in occupancy. At the same time, they've experienced significant costs in relation to making sure they're as safe as possible, investing in new procedures, in additional staffing, PPE, et cetera. So that's been a sector where near-term, the cash flows have been very difficult. Occupancies have declined pretty significantly. But we think the long-term fundamentals are very strong. And we do think it's primarily a need-based decision. Most people don't really want to move in these facilities, but when they have particularly on the assisted living side, when they have challenges with requirements for memory care or just physical help to be able to deal with some of the daily tasks, often, family members might not be able to provide that same level of care. That's really when it becomes a decision that's being taken. And we don't think there is a fundamental shift to that. There's just been a pause here due to the pandemic.
Now, data center and industrial real estate REITs have been among the main beneficiaries from the crisis, but what developments are you seeing in terms of valuation and supply levels in those areas?
Yeah, That's a good question. I think both of them have behaved a little bit differently, particularly in the data center space. The largest market for data centers globally was Northern Virginia, had actually over the last couple of years been going through a bit of an oversupply situation, where there was a lot of space that was coming online in a relatively short period of time, increasing the available supply, which we had thought might create some indigestion. The good news for the sector is that with COVID and the increase in data needs, a lot of that excess supply had been absorbed. So what would have looked at as a potential oversupply in the most important market has actually been absorbed, and the near-term outlook for supply in that market and more globally seems much more reasonable. And so that's, from a supply perspective, very positive. On the other hand, though, from a demand perspective, we have gone through a certain degree of pull forward, right, as demands on many of these cloud providers and entertainment providers had spiked in the aftermath of the pandemic. Some of that demand has gotten pulled forward. And so we've gone through a flurry of activity, particularly ready-to-go product to be leased and put into service. And we think there will be a bit more of a slowdown. If we look sort of further up in that channel, like in the companies that make the data centers, for example, we see much more of a slowdown in the next couple of quarters from the frenzy we've seen in the first and the second quarter. So we think their supply is much more in check, but we think demand will start to normalize as well. And then as people are going back to work and hopefully, you know, kids are starting to go back to school, I know for many of them that has been delayed across school systems in the United States. But, you know, we're hopeful that in the not distant future that happens too, then some of that incremental demand will start to also pare back a little bit. So that's on the data center side. On the logistics side, it's part of industrial real estate, and it's really been a bit of a tale of two cities. One has been pure logistics, which have been very strong, driven by the strong demand for e-commerce and a big acceleration there. So that's been an asset class that's been very strong. On the other hand, on more traditional manufacturing type, flex office type kind of facilities, that's been more soft in terms of demand, and that's definitely shining through. New developments had been paused in the second quarter almost across the board, but have started to pick up again. And we do think that we are going to see still a couple of quarters of really good demand as companies, again, still continuing to build out some of their profiles. On the flip side, we are starting to see some higher supply numbers coming in industrial as well. So that's an area watching pretty carefully, because historically that has certainly been an asset class that is on the side of easier to build. You know, it doesn't take as long for new product to be put into service. The build time is much lower than other asset classes, and the locational desirability of where exactly that warehouse needs to be is a little bit more flexible than if you want to build a, you know, 50-story CBD office building. It'll take much longer, and it needs to be in the CBD. So that's an area we're watching closely, but so far I would say the supply has picked up in industrial, but not too much.
Now, turning to the office sector, opinions seem to be all over the place regarding the function that offices will play in the future. How long do you think it will be before we have any more certainty as to the direction this is taking?
Yeah, office is a hotly debated topic for sure. And, you know, it's one of those that impacts everybody, and everybody has an opinion, and everybody has a relative or a friend, and some are coming back, and some will work remotely forever and starting to move to other places. And I think some of that uncertainty will continue to stay with us. As I mentioned earlier, we were one of the earlier ones to making it back to downtown Chicago offices. And I have to say, we do, you know, we appreciate how well it has worked while we were gone and we're, you know, working remotely. But we also appreciate being all together in one room and discussing some of these topics in a face-to-face basis. And I do think, again, it comes to back to some of those temporary versus permanent effects. We're not really going to know exactly what people's companies and individuals' decisions are going to be, but you know, often we tend to extrapolate some of the near-term behaviors or realities too far into the distance. And from my point of view, I do think that there was a really good reason why we all decided to meet for work in a dedicated place in the center of most large cities with access to public transportation and to roadways that makes it relatively easy for, to bring everybody from different parts of town together in order to be efficient about doing work. And some of the things that we haven't done for a while, of course, are also important, right? Like we haven't, I haven't visited, no company has visited me in 6 months. I have not visited any of my clients in 6 months. Nobody's come to our office to do any on-sites, et cetera. So yeah, could we do this for a while? No question. Could we keep doing it for a while? Yeah. Is this a desirable permanent state of conducting business? Our answer is probably no, certainly for our business. There might be others who are more conducive to that, but my guess would be many of those are already using that flexibility. We do think one of the more lasting effects will likely be that both companies and employees will find a bit more flexibility when it comes to coming to the office, i.e., they might say, okay, you can maybe work 2 days a week from home. We still want you to come. We still want you to have the experience. But you have some flexibility of not maybe coming in every day from exactly these hours to those hours, which is something that was probably overdue anyway. But this was sort of the catalyst that brought that one forward from our perspective.
Mm-hmm. Now, migration to Sunbelt states is something that you and I have talked about in the past. How much more runway do you think that this trend has?
Yeah. Look, I think we talked about this topic a fair bit back in 2018, really talking about some of the, you know, the factors that drive both individuals and corporates to make that move from some of the higher cost coastal cities to some of the Sunbelt markets, which are really growing up as cities. And some of those are still in place, right? It's a higher quality of life, it's a lower cost of living, shorter commute times, maybe some of the family formation decisions that particularly the millennial cohorts are starting to engage in. At some point, you probably want to move to the suburbs. If you have particularly more than one child, cities just a little bit more difficult to manage that. And so when COVID, so those were in place, we think those are generally still valid and are in place. You know, COVID has really done a couple of things. One is accelerated some of these trends. I would say particularly turned some of the positive ones for the urban markets into short-term negatives. You know, if you think about access to public transportation, you know, it's 24/7, it's big crowds, you know, that density of life, right, that was really that made up that urban fabric, which was so desirable to people, that was so hard to give up by moving to a smaller city or moving to a more suburban location, right? Those are currently, unfortunately, not that desirable or not that available. Having said that, we think some of those is clearly more of a temporary effect, and we do believe that we will get a solution to this pandemic where we can re-engage as people in what we actually like to do. You know, the reason we all decided to stay at home and not do nothing is not because that was a choice. It's important to remember that. It wasn't our choice. It was forced upon us because of fear of something worse happening to us. And so if that fear element goes away, we do think we want to come back to these experiences. Similarly with office, you know, before the pandemic happened, all the rage was about very dense spaces, lots of collaboration, lots of, you know, interaction off teams, right, where you have that serpentinous kind of, you know, things happening that you wouldn't necessarily be planned or hard to schedule a call for, right? Those things, I don't think that has gone away. We've kind of pushed the pause button on that. So those are effects that we think are positive and that will come back the moment the fear subsides. So in the short run, we think, so there are some valid trends that were in place, and some things have gotten a lot more negative for, I would say, the coastal cities. And what really catalyzed it in the short run is both additional, because of the recession, additional focus on cost, both by employees but also by employers, as well as the work from home element, where, you know, some companies have indicated longer term durations of flexibility to work from wherever you want, that making, of course, the move to other locations much more easy. And so we've seen some, you know, real tangible evidence over the last few months of some people making that move. Again, we think that's an accelerant, but it's more temporary in nature. We think longer term, we're a big believer in value as well as the longevity of some of the coastal urban markets, and really the attraction that it brings to people to have this aggregation of folks all in one place. So that's sort of where we land on it. But I think we're not going to get much clarity on this for some time to come.
Okay. And finally, we're seeing the REIT model being introduced in countries including China and Sri Lanka. Could the current economic uncertainty impact the pace of global expansion of listed real estate?
I think there could be a temporary, you know, a slowdown of some of that. But in my view, this will likely actually accelerate some of that rather than slow it down. If you look at the experience that happened after the global financial crisis, what we found is that actually, while being in the short run much more volatile and in a way much more vulnerable from investors running away from listed real estate than they would have been from direct real estate investments, for example, they were also fastest to come back to that. And we saw, particularly in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, a lot of public companies, whether it's through secondaries or through initial IPOs, being able to access the capital markets and getting much better access and pricing than many comparable companies in the private markets, and therefore really accelerating their growth and their ability to act both on the acquisition front, but also on putting capital in their portfolios to get them ready to release them to new tenants and or even start new developments. And we're starting to see the very early signs of that happening, of public companies starting to access the capital markets, both in order to shore up their balance sheet even more in a sort of a defensive kind of way where that is needed, although there's not that many cases where that is needed, quite frankly, or more likely in cases where they're saying, okay, like for example, in data centers, we saw that in a number of companies where they are seeing very good, strong demand, others maybe not being a little bit more slow or a little bit more handcuffed in their access to capital, and them really being able to step forward and actually accelerate their development program. So we would expect more of that to come in starting in the fall and into next year.
Okay, great. Bernhard, thank you so much for your time today.
Not at all, Sarah. It's great speaking to you as always.
And to our listeners, you can subscribe to the REIT Report by visiting iTunes or wherever else you choose to download podcasts from.